this week in the markets. U.S. shares blasted higher, wrapping up an epic four-month rally on Friday. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you on GoldSeek.com Radio. Back with you on this Season 14, Episode 691 show. In this week's show, it's great to introduce a new guest, the head of the Diehold Foundation, Dr. Douglas Vogt. Makes his debut in part one of what I think you may find could be one of the most important interviews in over a decade here on the show. He's the author of several must-read books and some fantastic videos on YouTube. His message is one that I think every global inhabitant must take seriously. We could be facing some very serious geological and cosmological issues, let's just say, within the next three decades. So then the head of Armstrong Economics, Martin Armstrong, rejoins the show in part two of the discussion. He looks at the presidential cycle and the U.S. stock market performance, and outlines which index he thinks global investors will be focusing their capital on, noting that shares could climb 50% from current levels. And if you'd like to sign up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter, we continue to blast away the competition. New stock candidates provided a new portfolio each week. We don't toss darts and we don't use tea leaf reading or any of that nonsense. It's purely scientific. We use portfolio analysis so you can, you know, review the expected return of the portfolio each week. And there's always something new. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. You can call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, followed by extension number 5140-49, 24-7. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with a market weather recap. Partly sunny skies persisted over the precious metals sector again this week, as investors were mostly neutral over the economic numbers and the Fed minute meetings. By Friday's closing bell, the precious metal indices were near break-even, with the yellow metal around the 1,300 points. Silver was off just less than 1%, around $15, and the XAU precious metals finished off 1% as well, around 76. Black gold, though, bucked the trend, adding 1%, up a dollar, at 63.89. Palladium added 4.30, and platinum pulled back $7. The top story driving the metals higher this week, the jobless number came in below expectations. That was below actually 200,000 for the first time in about 50 years, falling by 8,000 to 196,000 in March, brings the monthly low to 180,000 over the past several months, with February's very low number. Plus, we also have the unemployment rate at multi-decade lows as well. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve released the March monetary policy meeting that came in around the anticipated level, indicated the decision in March to wrap up their rate hike cycle was the result of sluggish forecasts for the global economy and lower than expected inflation. The minutes confirmed that the economic data is solid and we could see a rate decline by the end of this year. We see currently, though, only about a 33% odds of a rate decline at the Fed Funds futures contract at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. In related news, on Thursday, the Silver Institute Silver Survey indicated that demand for the precious metal climbed to a three-year high, up by about 4%, 1 billion ounces last year, indicating that silver bar demand is strong, up 53%. Global silver mine production curtailed for the third year in a row, down 2% by nearly a billion ounces. So that's just a best of world scenario. Increased demand, lowered output, doesn't get much better for silver. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, the fundamental picture for the metals remains strong. Some signs of inflation were seen in the producer price index report this week, and we still have the Brexit drama as a wild card for the safe haven bet. In addition, the International Monetary Fund cut its expectations of the global economic output. That's the third cut now in 6 months. Data indicated this week that jobless claims were lower. So if you add it all up, you have the prospect of higher inflation, a slightly more dovish Fed, and a subdued U.S. dollar. I like the prospects for gold. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies were seen over the New York Stock Exchange this week as investors cheered better than expected domestic economic numbers amid the first quarter earnings season. By Friday's closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow was near break even at 26,412, while the S&P 500 picked up 15 points, ending at 28,92, and the NASDAQ added 46 points, just shy of 8,000 at 79,84. Meanwhile, the enthusiasm over first quarter earnings continued to build across a broad spectrum of industries, including the financials, transportation, consumer products, technology, and many others. Morgan Chase's quarterly earnings report was very positive, with Jamie Dimon noting that the U.S. economy could expand 4 years. Turning to U.S. shares in the news, Jim Cramer of Mad Money's CNBC fame during a lightning round says he likes Spotify. He thinks it's only a matter of time before subscriptions take over. This is a good one, he said, and I agree with him. It's a solid opportunity, I think, to move higher here. Ticker symbol SPOT. He thinks investors could start to flock to the FANG stocks. And last week's Alpha Stock Candidates, my flagship newsletter, had two FANG candidates. So if you haven't already signed up, we'd like you on board. And if you have, be sure and log in to this weekend's newsletter. U.S. shares, bottom line. The USA Today Greed to Fear Index remains at an elevated level, but it's not quite really overbought, so we could see further gains. For the time being, nothing seems to curb investors' enthusiasm for shares, and now that the Fed might start to loosen up monetary policy within the next 2 years and maybe begin a fresh round of QE, I would not at all be surprised to see an assault on record highs in the next few weeks to months ahead. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.
It's just a real pleasure to welcome, on his debut appearance here, Douglas Vogt, who has a truly uncanny knack for revealing anomalies. He has uncovered material that I believe is so groundbreaking.
How is the weather today in that part of Florida?
Sun's out, warm.
And I assume you probably also relocated, like so many of your neighbors, from another part of the U.S.
Yep, and August of 2015, we moved here from Bellevue, Washington. Summer was about a month and a half to 2 months long, if we were lucky. And the rest of the time was overcast and gray. Didn't snow too many times, believe it or not, but rain plenty.
Just beautiful down there. Your material is very extensive, but I'd like to give folks just a quick synopsis of what, having gone over all your videos, some of the key takeaways. What I've been able to gather here, you believe that we have a sun that approximately every 12,000 years has what appears to be a micronova, where projectile light, not just plasma, it rains all over our solar system. There's evidence you've found on the moon, you've proven. There's evidence all over this Earth that you've actually uncovered, like an archaeologist or a paleontologist. This seems to resolve unexplained anomalies that current mainstream theories just can't explain.
First of all, you have to remember, in order for me to have discovered what causes the Ice Age and why it happens immediately after a geomagnetic reversal, also known as a polar reversal, is I had developed an information theory of existence. I think I'm the first one in history to do it. And it was in my first book called Reality Revealed, The Theory of Multidimensional Reality. Unfortunately, there's no money. It's out of print, and the ones that were on Amazon were going for between $400 to $1,100, and they sold fast. I may reprint parts of that book, but without that philosophy that the universe is the product of information, I never could have figured out most of these.
Folks, you have to keep in mind, this individual came up with this theory 4 decades plus. This is way before the simulation hypotheses that we're hearing coming from mainstream or the simulated universe.
See, when you write a textbook rather than a novel, then people could take your information, not give me any credit, and Roland Emmerich did it in three of his movies. So it's just par for the course. You just get used to it. But the main issue is this. I figured out the exact number of years between reversals, which is 12,068 years. I found it in 1989 by doing a database of all known stars, Oma clusters, and globular clusters. The stuff I'm telling you now, you can go see and they're like classes. On YouTube, search for Diehold Foundation channel, and then it's series one, part two is how I found this clock cycle. The reason why it's important now is because the next clock cycle appears to be in 27 and a half years from now, when the next Gleisberg cycle happens. And when that happens, the sun does nova. That's the thing that causes the ice age. You have to look for the heat rather than the cold. The cold comes later. In order to have an ice field that's, like in Seattle, we had one supposedly at 4,000 feet thick, that represents about 19,000 feet of snow. Needless to say, this is not a normal snowfall. And it was accumulated within 40 years about. So you have to figure it out backwards, and what I'm about to tell you, it never shows up in any geology books, geography books, meteorological books, nothing. So if you have that much ice and snow, on the other side of the equation has to be a certain number of calories of heat exerted on the ocean to evaporate a lot of ocean water to eventually become clouds that dump on you, eventually snow, and it becomes ice. When you got an accumulation of enough, you know, you got thousands of feet of ice, you're going to, it's from thousands of feet of snow compressed down. So that's the thing. Now, regarding the CIA, my first book came out in 77, later 77. I did some radio shows then, and I did get a call from the Army in Fort Lewis. I was living in Bellevue. They called me up, and they said they had a, try not to laugh too hard, this is a true story. They said they had a ghost in the attic of their military museum. I didn't click what they were really trying to tell me. About a month and a half later, a guy called me up from Tacoma, which is just the outskirts of Fort Lewis, and said he was calling regarding my book, Reality Revealed, and he wanted to know. And he asked me, how did I figure it out? How did I know what caused the ice age and everything like that? Later on in the conversation, he said he was a retired CIA. I'll explain why the military said they had a ghost in the attic. What do we call spies? Well, that's also a name we use for ghosts. So he was saying he had a spy, a CIA agent there, and he wanted to talk to me. I didn't connect it, and I don't know why they didn't want to say it on the telephone, but that was my first encounter with the CIA.
What you've described wouldn't surprise any of us here, and you are right in your assessment. The individual is most likely concerned that the wire was not a secure line transmission. But again, you weren't in intelligence at the time, so you wouldn't be looking for those cues. In some of the videos we've already posted, we'll continue posting all of them. Got to encourage everyone to bookmark the Diehold Foundation on YouTube. That's your first go-to, and then, of course, the Diehold Foundation website. We'll get to all that at the end. Please elaborate on the geological evidence that you present in one of your videos that shows the deep erosion around the continents that can only be described by extremely fast-flowing or flood-like events. Later on, I'd love for you to get to your clock cycle, and more importantly, perhaps, the actual Diehold itself, diagram that you've come up with that shows at the Planck level.
It's a complex series of events. That's in video series 4, and I think it goes up to series of G on one of them. I mean, it's just that many pieces to this thing. But when the sun novas, some of the geological evidence found in the solar system and on the Earth are these glass beads. They're very small, 1 millimeter and smaller. And the chemical composition of the glass beads and also iron, nickel beads, little tiny beads, and magnetite also, found on the moon and on the Earth were the same chemical composition. The Europeans landed on a comet 67P. I have the original papers. And the chemical composition of the comet was the same material that was found on those glass beads on the sedimentary layers at the same level of a geomagnetic reversal as the same stuff found on the moon. NASA and also the CIA know. It looks like CIA was stuck with the job of having to investigate it and deal with it. And I actually feel sorry for them being stuck with this kind of a job, which was outside the purview of what the law that created them, but they were stuck with the job because they could keep a secret. This particular thing does not keep a secret well. As you'll find out when you see the videos, how they were involved in the National Science Foundation and how they basically control what papers get researched and published. And that's why they've been doing this for like 60 years. So you've got three generations of scientists, geologists and astrophysicists, thinking only one way, and because they don't know, or they aren't experts in a lot of different fields. You have to be like a Renaissance person. Some of these PhDs are excellent in describing the molecules on the bark of a tree, but can't tell you that tree is part of a forest or part of a continent or is on a planet. They're very, very narrowly focused. And that's the major problem. I had to wind up reading a lot of textbooks, a lot of different fields, and also read the journal Science, Nature, Geology from about the mid-50s to about the beginning of the 90s. And that's how I knew the schism between what they teach in the textbooks is like night and day what's in the journals. And I realized, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Why are they teaching something that's obviously wrong? And I think a lot of it's due to government not wanting the people to know the real mechanism. In the beginning, they didn't know when this thing was going to happen. I quote a letter I got from a guy named Ken Kuzman. His cousin was an astrophysicist up in Alaska, and his job was to figure out where Jupiter became solid, because they thought it was a near sun, didn't quite make it. In other words, they were looking for the missing heat. And I actually have his journal articles. It was published in Science. I know who it is. And so his story was true, and I spoke to him on the phone besides the letter he sent me. And you'll see the letter on the website in the video.
Have you ever considered the fact that Jupiter, using your model, the Diehold model, and Saturn at some point were suns and may have had micronovas of themselves, explaining much of the topology and geological anomalies on the surrounding moons, not to mention the rings of Saturn?
I define dimensions differently. I define dimensions by how much information that existence has and how much potential it has. And there's a big difference between a planet and a star. It was once a planet in the same orbit as the Earth is now. When this star novas, it pushes the planets a little further out. I don't know how much further. It could be 50,000 miles, it could be 100,000 miles. Eventually, the planet loses most of its water, and it gets too cold and too far away from the sun. Go look at Mars. That it shows obvious rivers and channels and oceans, and guess where all that water went? It got evaporated out.
Again, you've just resolved at least three key anomalies.
On the deep sea canyons on the Earth, they look exactly like the ones that are on Mars, because Mars had an ocean. What causes ours, on the edge of every single continental shelf, regardless of what continent, you'll see these deep canyons and smaller canyons along the entire length of any of the continental shelves. Off the east coast of the United States, it's like 200 to 400 miles out, and then it goes down. And it goes down to about 10 to 11,000 feet below current sea level. Some of them, like the Delaware Canyon, the Oceanographer Canyon, the Hudson River Canyon. And they built a deep-sea submarine, the Navy paid for it, called the Alvin back in the 60s, and they did that to see what was down there. Was there any currents that could have done this? And if anyone's taken chemistry 101, you know that fresh water is lighter than salt water because salt water has salt in it and a whole bunch of other minerals in it. So a fresh water can only do an alluvial plain such as the Nile Delta, the Mississippi Delta, etc. So the question is what formed all these canyons all over the world? And this is what happens. At the time of the reversal, our Earth's rotation stops. It slows down weeks beforehand, and it stops for about 7 to 8 hours and then goes in the opposite direction.
Could you please throw in the interesting anomalies, the fossilized sea life, and just how that ties in, actually proves your theory?
Oh, yeah, and plus a bunch of mythologies also. But yes, the last time the Earth rotated in the opposite direction, so the sun rose in the west and set in the east, so it rotated, and if you look down at it would be clockwise rather than counterclockwise, which is now if you look down from the North Pole. So what happened when the Earth stopped its rotation, the Pacific Ocean rushed over China and Southeast Asia. And the Chinese to this day have a mythology that, and the evidence is that you find fish bones and other things in the Gobi Desert. Because, and the mythology says the ocean ran over the place. That's what happened.
I have another anomaly for you may not have even thought of, that the key pyramids of Egypt, they have now just found seashells at 60 to 85 feet within the pyramids.
It's the drainage area for the Great Plains. So when the ocean went from the Atlantic to the Pacific, it basically dumped and drained out that way. And this doesn't happen just once. Like, back to the deep-sea canyons. So if you were standing last time on the Pacific side, let's say in California, you'd see the ocean rushing away from you real fast. And if you could go past the continental shelf, you could look down to the bottom of the Pacific. And on the other side, though, it was the Atlantic Ocean rush over the continent, over the Appalachians, and through the Great Plains, and worked its way all the way to the Pacific. That's what you got, that Monterey Deep Sea Canyon, which is very impressive, but that's on the West Coast. Same thing goes to the Deep Sea Canyon off the Columbia River in Washington State. They can't explain those, but that's the reason why. There was temporarily no ocean water there. This time, in the way the Earth rotates now, if you're on the Atlantic side, and when the reversal happens, you'll see the Atlantic Ocean rushing away from you really fast. If you could fly and go to the edge of the continental shelf, you'd look right down to the bottom of the Atlantic, because all that water is going east towards Europe and Africa, and that's where it's going. But on the west coast, you'll have the Pacific Ocean. I wouldn't say the entire Pacific, because I don't know how much of it is going to go over the continents, the Americas, but you can't stop it. It's not like a tsunami tidal wave. It's not like that at all. This is the entire mass of the Pacific Ocean coming towards you real fast.
I'd just like to throw in here that all of this work, everything from the Diehold Foundation, all the videos and the literature, are annotated in a way that really approaches APA level annotation. I mean, this is legit. The next anomaly I'd like for you to address that your work, I believe, resolves, it's one that has confounded paleontologists for quite some time, is the woolly mammoth and the rhino phenomenon, the instant freezing in the northern latitude, of course, Siberia and all over northern Canada. I mean, we just find a woolly mammoth just chewing food and just standing as though they were still walking. Another anomaly that your work proves, they've just found instantly frozen sea waves 20 feet high in Antarctica.
Okay, this explains kind of both. Actually, I think it's higher than 20 feet. I have a picture of it in one of the things, and it looks like it's much higher than 20 feet. But this is how it happened. There's two stages to this thing. When the Earth stops its rotation for 7 to 8 hours, that side of the Earth is basically cooked and baked. Everything that's above the surface that's organic is going to burn. That's why you have, the scientists have found, a higher incidence of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide in the gas bubbles in the ice fields, because that's a lot of stuff burning, and the byproduct is CO2. So then the Earth starts rotating again in the opposite direction. 17 to 18 hours after the reversal started, almost the opposite side, gets hit with this dust shell that has the glass beads in it and microtactites and blobs of glass. And last time, that was basically, if you took a longitude running through New York and Brazil, that's how I think it went. And exactly on the other side of it is Siberia. And so this is what happens. The dust shell hits the sun side, the side that gets nailed.
Could you please just start with the initial heating? Explain that this is really a two-stage process that then leads to cataclysms beyond belief. Thank you.
Right. It's basically the nova happens. Earth stops its rotation at that moment for 78 hours is what I estimate. Then it starts rotating in the opposite direction. So, but it takes about 17 to 18 hours for that dust shell from the nova to actually reach the Earth.
So if I might interject just quickly, we get a flash burn, you might say, and perhaps followed by a plasma burn. This probably occurs for a few minutes to maybe a few hours. There's a calm before the storm. The Earth turns, let's say, 12 hours or so on its axis.
Yeah, the dust shell hits. When the dust shell hits, it'll evacuate a lot of atmosphere on that side of the Earth.
Can I just say you've just proven another anomaly? This is one of my favorites. It's one I've been working on for years, and why? The surface of the sun is so unbelievably cool, roughly 7,000 degrees Fahrenheit, instead of much, much higher as it is further. So funny, because I hypothesized this years ago, and I wrote a paper on it. But my hypothesis was it was being cooled by a crust-like outer layer. Again, this supports your hypothesis.
It evacuates a lot of the atmosphere on that side of the Earth. It would have been South America, Central, and across Brazil, a longitude run through Brazil. The backside still has normal atmospheric pressure, and that would be Siberia and part of China and Russia. So what happened was, after the dust shell passes us, the speed of the dust shell I estimate at 1,550 miles per second. Astronomers have estimated from other novas that they've seen that the dust shell is about 1,500 miles per second. I believe it's like 1,550 miles per second, not much of a difference. So I'm not the only one that says these things expand very rapidly. When it passes the Earth, I don't know how deep it is also. It could be a couple hundred thousand miles. It could be a million miles deep. I just don't know. We do know it finally stalls out what they call the Kuiper belt, K-U-I-P-E-R belt. Past Uranus and Neptune, and that's our remnant dust shells from our sun's previous novas.
Again, disproving the mainstream idea or concept that all of that dust and comets and outside of the general solar system, you might call it, let's call it the fringe of the solar system. They believe that is a remnant of the founding of the solar system. Again, the Diehold Foundation disproves that and hypothesizes that it's the result of many micronovas. First, we have the blast of energy. So you see this incredible flash of light on one side of the Earth, and approximately 12 hours or so later, on the other side, it is smashed by these small particles. And that, of course, causes an instantaneous vacuum, which then does what? When you have a vacuum, instantly, you have an incredible freeze.
It's 1,550 miles per second.
Thank you.
After the dust shell passes, one side of the Earth is extremely low atmospheric pressure. The backside is normal. So what happens? The normal expands rapidly around the Earth to fill up the extremely low atmospheric pressure. Boyle's law, when you have an expanding gas, temperature drops. That's what fast froze the mammoths, mastodons, cave lions, woolly rhinoceroses.
And the Antarctic waves, exactly.
Yeah, that's how... Yeah, right. They were also... Where they found it was also on the backside when it happened. And it just freezes it solid. It's probably below 170 to 190 degrees below Fahrenheit. Well, it was below zero. I don't know how cold it'll get, but that's really the job of NOAA and NASA to go figure that out. I don't have to. We pay them a lot of money. Let them go figure out the details of this thing, where they can go model it. When the ocean water goes over the continent, when it reaches the other side, it pours generally through the river channels that already exist, but over everything. That's why the entire length of a continental shelf has these smaller canyons all through the whole thing. It just pours over it. Now, it doesn't have one reversal. This is multiple reversals, hundreds of, if not thousands of reversals, made these deep canyons. But the ocean goes literally over the entire continent. I'm going to do videos on volumes 1, 2, and 3 on decoding the Hebrew scriptures. And you'll know why Abraham bought that cave and what Moses did. And you'll actually see the whole Exodus story and everything I found that Moses describes. In other words, he wasn't a fictional character. Fictional characters do not leave physical evidence behind. Simple as that.
Absolutely. And folks, if you haven't seen these videos, bookmark the Die Hold Foundation. Try one or two. Try especially the first few, and I promise you'll be as hooked as I am. Douglas Volt, thank you, sir.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. Goldseek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
Goldseek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Featured guest today says the European Central Bank is at risk of failing, which could send interest rates soaring, outlines contingency plans for investors to shield their portfolios. Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, and founder of Princeton Economics. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Just take the issue of the wall, okay? $5.7 billion out of a $1.3 trillion, budget. We're not even talking about 0.1. So it's just a political issue. The Iran for it, we have to oppose it. It's not whether it's good or bad for the country. This is what we're into.
An article popped up from the Pentagon that said they have agreed to at least $1 billion of the funding of that simply to secure our borders. Again, I don't want to get into the political fray. I'm a political atheist. At least our military recognizes there is a clear and present threat to our sovereignty.
Well, absolutely. Look, I mean, if you really wanted to be a terrorist, you were smart, you just fly into one of the South American countries and you can walk across the border. I mean, you can't get on a plane, you can't go to Canada and come. I mean, it's open season. Anybody with a rational mind would do that, but, they turn into a political issue. Get on a plane going to Europe after 2021. I mean, you got to be clear to even get on a plane.
Your models have been spot on so far in the past few years you've been on the show, and my guess is you have a feel for where we end up in 2019, maybe early 2020. Isn't it true that the year of a presidential or the year before a presidential election starts to get interesting in U.S. equities? Do you see something similar this time?
Well, I think the primary driving force behind the U.S. equity market has been foreign capital inflows. Simple as that. And all you have to do is look at the three indexes. The Dow reflects international capital. It just look at like the Japanese and Chinese when they come over and buy real estate. What do? They Rockefeller Center. They buy the trophies. Okay, they don't go down, you know, the side street in Poughkeepsie and start buying up $200,000 houses. They're not interested in that. So in equities, it's the same thing. They will come in and they'll buy the big names. They feel comfortable with that. It's impressive. Okay. They'll buy some in the S&P 500. They really stay away from the NASDAQ. So what you get is the Dow is the big capital international. The S&P is a little mix between domestic institutions and international. And NASDAQ's mostly retail. So the Dow coming out of December led everything. Okay, now the Dow started peaking off a little bit. You have the NASDAQ still going up, making highs when the Dow has not. So that's showing the retail market coming in more and not necessarily the domestic, you know, the international side. The S&P made new highs above February, but not the Dow. So these are things to kind of look at to see where the it just, you know, visually we'll show you where capital is actually moving from. And what we have to understand is that the amount of money that's out there in the bond markets is about 10 to 1 to equities. And I know you get a lot of people saying, oh, the U.S. dollar has got to crash. We've got a, you know, $21 trillion deficit. We have $150 plus trillion debt market out there. The U.S. is a tiny fraction of it. And you've got the ECB has destroyed its bond market with its quantitative easing. So does the Bank of Japan. This is why the dollar is so strong. The Bank of Japan bragged that they bought 97% of the auction. That's a good thing. That means there is no private bid. Okay, the same thing with the ECB. I mean, a pension fund needs generally 8% to break even. They can't buy 10-year, you know, bonds from Italy at 1.5% to 3%. They're guaranteed a loss. So this is why they've been going into emerging markets. This is why you see a lot of them. They've been buying farmland, for example. Why do they buy a big tracts of farmland? They rent it out. They're collecting 5% to 7% on rents. That's great for them. That's much better than what they can earn in a bond. So there have been shifts. And this is the shift that we've been talking about. We're moving, you know, from public to private. The U.S. will be the last. Okay, just as I just said, there's no, you know, there's nobody offering 90-day paper. It's been bought up by everybody. Yet you've got emerging market problems. Your banking system is catastrophic. And the ECB is something completely different than the Fed. People think the central banks are the same. The ECB can actually go, you know, bankrupt.
They're not as solidified among the, you know, we have 12 to 13 member banks. They have their own sovereign rules and whatnot. So it's more of a loose central bank, isn't it? Even though the EU is a larger block and maybe even stronger economically, they don't have as tight of a rein, you might say.
Each member kept its own central bank. And that local central bank is the one that actually prints the euros. The ECB does not print. So it's very, very convoluted. The structure was set up to pretend they still had their sovereignty, but at the same time they wanted to say that it didn't exist.
Now that the Fed might be entering a more dovish quantitative easing, that could potentially put, I guess, the U.S. dollar in a negative real interest rate scenario, which tends to bode well for the precious metals, which are oftentimes, you know, priced in U.S. dollars. Do you have any forecasts there or any thoughts for our precious metals aficionados?
I mean, we're going to be heading back up finally in the metals, but you're looking at, you know, next year. The critical thing here is, you know, who do you trust and what do you believe? And it's not a question of, I mean, like you said, for the last, you know, 20 years, everybody's saying, oh, you know, the hard money guys, this, that. What they're all talking to each other. And that doesn't matter. When I go to Starbucks and I stand in line, you know, the young kids in front of me, they don't have cash. They just hold up their phone. All right. You know, each generation is a little bit different. And I would say the biggest risk you have with the precious metals going forward is that the younger generations don't look at it the same way. I just posted an article that I wrote. It was quite funny. A woman found a handful of $20 gold pieces. She went to Walmart and tried to spend them, and they wouldn't accept them.
Don't you wish you were the cashier that day?
I mean, I know. So obviously, they have no clue. It says $20. Well, I don't know what it is. So Walmart says you got to go to a bank and cash them in over there. She goes to the bank. She goes to cash them in. They look at $20. They give her a $20 bill.
That's where, about 20 years ago when I was starting in the numismatics, we would always go to the Walmart, any bank that was adjacent to the Walmarts, because people will take their half dollars in dollars, and they're, you know, the 40 and 90% silver pieces, and they don't think anything of it. So you would find the bulk of them in what you might say the higher volume Walmart areas. You could just get a roll or two of silver coins. Your thoughts on the younger generation, the Generation Z and millennials, they're not, as you say, interested in precious metals yet. Their focus is more in the direction of cryptos. Do you have any thoughts for Bitcoin now that we've let the air out of the tires that we might have another run in the cryptocurrencies?
The cryptocurrencies are just a trading vehicle. I mean, there's no shot at this actually displacing the dollar and all that sort of stuff. You have to realize, you know, he who has the guns makes the rules, all right? If anybody thinks that they can create a private currency that's going to circumvent the central banks and all this stuff, then it's a pipe dream. I mean, you start threatening the power of government, they're just going to come in. The SEC and CFTC are already after a lot of crypto currencies, kind of changed the whole industry. Now, I do think that you're probably going to see them back towards the more on the equity side. It seems to be what they are more of an investor type thing. And I think they will eventually come back into like some precious metals. But you have to understand, we have to get to that point that it becomes more commonly known. We haven't reached that yet, and that's probably starting next year. That's when people begin to question the validity of government.
Just quick thoughts on the precious metals equities. It would seem as though there's some value there. We've seen several stocks in recent weeks perk up and show some signs of life, and a few even breaking out this week. Your thoughts on the XAU and the HUI and any other components that you like?
Institutions can at least buy the precious metal equities. They can't really buy the bullion. And mainly because, you know, they have to earn income. The ones that will deal with the bullion end up usually because they're buying the bullion and then they lease it out. And then people accuse them of suppressing the gold price. But they have to earn income. They can't just simply take it and put it in a vault like a retail investor can. They have to pay, you know, pension premiums and things of this nature. So anything they do must have an income to it. And so they can do the precious metal equities as long as they get dividends. But just taking something and put it in a sock drawer, that's not what an institution can do. Our economic confidence model, which is kind of really tracks the business cycle, we're into this final leg of it, which is we're going to see more of a hard landing outside the United States in particular, but it's also why the Fed is backing off to some degree. That tends to bottom in the first quarter next year and then starts to turn up. So I'm looking at that stage in the game for the perception to change. And that's the critical thing. Although the stock market has rallied quite dramatically, a friend of mine, I mean, I check, you know, regularly, cash in deposits at some of the biggest brokerage houses are at record highs. the retail sold, and they were, you know, listened to all this stuff. Oh, the stock market's going to crash. They missed this last rally again. They've said, look, you know, cash in people's accounts is at record highs back at 2000, you know, 08 and 09 levels. So you have not the potential for a major crash because not everybody's in it. All right. You have more of the potential of a major blowout to the upside because once they see that this thing is just going to go up, that's it. You know, government, we can't trust. Where do I put my money? Bonds, you start getting, you know, more states in trouble. There's no place to go but up. You have so many governments outside the United States that are in trouble, and U.S. will be the last. And this is what you'll have to understand. U.S. is reserve currency. It's not the place where anything starts. It always starts in the peripheral. All right. Even during, you know, the Great Depression, there was a financial, you know, crisis in 31. Most of Europe defaulted. Even Britain went into a moratorium. You know, Asia defaulted. You can go on eBay and buy bonds. You know, South America defaulted for like the fourth time. All right. So that's why the dollar went up so high during the Great Depression. The politicians misunderstood it. They started protectionism because the dollar was up so high, everybody could undercut us on everything. So politicians don't understand the system. And so the dollar going up is not fantastic. That is the sign that it's going to break the system. If you look at what has happened, when the dollar went up dramatically in 1931, What did it do? It led to basically, you know, Roosevelt coming into power, confiscation of gold, devaluation of the dollar. All right. When the next time the dollar went up really dramatically into 1985, the British pound went to par. What did they do? They formed G5. That's how G5 began. The whole premise of it, to force the dollar down by 40%. You know, so it's the dollar going up that breaks the monetary system, not going down. If the dollar goes down, as these people, oh, the dollar is going to crash, you know, that will be fantastic. Corporate profits will rise. Trump will be, you know, beside himself. Trade, we're creating all kinds of jobs. The U.S. always wants a lower dollar. It's everybody else that they think they want a higher currency. That means they're doing good. No, it does not. It means you can't sell anything and you're going to get deflation.
One of your key takeaway points here for our, you know, everyday portfolio investor is don't get scared off the bull. We're climbing a wall of worry still a decade later. Joseph Granville, the people just have a tendency to get nervous. They read too many headlines that get them off their game. Just let the portfolio dynamics work.
Yeah, I mean, the markets don't lie. You know, it's largely the TV, you know, talking heads. People ask me, gee, why don't you go, you know, on TV? I don't have the time to go fly into some studio or whatever. I'm too busy for that. So the people that end up doing that usually are the ones that don't have a business. So it's just the way it is. I mean, they all say the same thing. Stock market's going to crash. This. Just ask, okay, fine, the stock market's going to crash. The bonds go up. Do you really want to buy more government, you know, sovereign bonds? And people say no. The Dow is going to go up much higher. We're eventually, you know, we'll see, honestly, we'll see probably 40,000 before you'll ever see, you know, 10,000. That's just the way it is.
That's really, I think, the takeaway point today. That's the headline here. We'll see 40,000 before we see 10,000 on the Dow. Let's talk again in 2019.
Thank you for inviting me.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. Goldseek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind and markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. The potential nomination of Herman Cain by President Trump to the board of the Federal Reserve has been discussed in various corners of the financial world. I was going to urge you to type Herman Cain debates Bill Clinton into YouTube and watch the 3-minute video clip from a town hall meeting in the early 1990s in which Mr. Cain asked Clinton about employer costs for the national health care plan Bill and Hillary Clinton were then peddling to the American people. Clinton's answer demonstrated his complete and utter ignorance about the economics of how small business operates and how costs are calculated. It is an absolute must-watch video. The media and format of the questions are respectful. Complete thoughts are actually addressed during the exchange, unlike the weaponized media and theatrically staged town hall meetings that exist across the spectrum today. This town hall question was my first introduction to Herman Cain. I met him several years later at a speaking engagement and have followed his periodic participation in the political spotlight ever since. Cain is also known for his interest in sound money, as in some kind of gold standard. So when his name was suggested as a possible nominee for the board of the Federal Reserve, it didn't take long for 4 Republican senators, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Cory Gardner of Colorado, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Kevin Cramer of North Dakota to publicly announce they would not support Cain. And speaking of weaponized media, none other than the Washington Post ran a hit piece on both Cain and the gold standard, titled, "Trump's Latest Fed Picks Have Supported the Gold Standard," to which the subtitle reads, "It's one of the worst economic ideas in the world." This article is yet another wastebasket collection of faulty economic arguments that get trotted out and stitched together every time media apologists for debt-based money want to demonize the very real change and accountability that sound money represents. And because still only about 0.5% of the investing public has any exposure to gold, the demonization of the yellow metal will continue, while America and the world are riveted to the next installment of the Mueller Report, or the next statement from Bill Barr on investigating the investigators, or what some fringe members of Congress say or do on a daily basis. Remember, these are all political distractions. The real fight, the real propaganda, The real issues are all hidden in plain view, right in front of your very eyes. The subtle, almost unnoticed, yet coordinated hit job on Herman Cain is just one more example of how the official narrative is controlled and maintained at the expense of people and ideas that represent actual change. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Thank you.